Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your host today is Bean Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group.
And good evening. How is everybody doing tonight? As you heard there in the opening, it's just me tonight. My co-host, Mr. Stephen Gies, is out on the road right now, down in Florida, I believe. So it's going to be me tonight. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to do something a little different. I'm going to kind of open the phones up, open up Twitter, and we're going to talk about works in progress. So if you're an author or a musician working on new material, if you have a works in progress, feel free to call in and share what it's about. Tell us a little bit something about your writing technique. And I'll share a few of my projects. I've got two or three going right now. But there's all kinds of different things out there that we'll talk about. So so here's the thing. If you have something you want to share, if you have a work in progress, like I said, it can even be a musical one because we got a lot of musicians that listen to the program. You can leave a comment or a question on Twitter using the hashtag Fresh Ink Group. That's hashtag Fresh Ink Group, not at Fresh Ink Group. Okay. We have that where people use the Twitter handle. We're not going to see that during the show. Hashtag the pound or number symbol and Fresh Ink Group, and put that out on Twitter and I will see it. I'll be checking every few minutes or so. But I would like to have some of you call in. Make this a program where it's interactive with the listening audience. And the phone not line is 516-453-9902. Once again, that is 516-453-9902. So, works in progress. As I stated, I've got a couple going on right now, but I've got one that's it's completed, it's finished, and it hasn't been released yet. And it's part of a fantastic series of short story collections called Concordant Vibrancy. Concordant Vibrancy, and that's published by All Authors Publishing House. And they've just recently put together Concordant Vibrancy 5, Extancy. Each of them have a different name to them and a theme. This is the fifth one. I've taken part in the last four. I wasn't part of the first one, but the last four, I have been totally honored to have been invited to participate with this. And I have a short story in there, and Concordant Vibrancies, Extancies. It's a short story collection based on a theme question. And the theme question for this new one is extancy, or actually it's called extancy, and extancy is a derivative of the word extant, meaning to survive or still exist. And as I said, I've contributed to four of the five, and the theme question for this one is what intangible elixir is paramount to one's survival? And my short story in there is 5 minutes in one night, 38 years ago, changed the paths of a group of friends. They all had their lives planned out. They were sports heroes on the local high school sports teams. They had college scholarships and just everything was planned out for them. And one bad thing happened, and it completely changed everybody involved. And so that's, but one of them survived. He's the one telling the story. They all survived. But the one who survived and is telling the story, he was put on a different path. And it wasn't anything like he originally thought his life would be. But in the end, where he's at is where he was meant to be. So this has a release date that the Concordant Vibrancy 5, Extancy, has a release date of January 12th. Now, there's going to be a blog tour running from January 3rd through January 11th, with the 12th being the release date. And if you want to follow along that blog tour, just keep checking back on my Twitter account, which is at BeamWeeks. And I'll be putting the links to the various stops on there once they come in. But this was a lot of fun. This is Yasmin Correa and Monica Brown, a.k.a. Queen of Spades, two amazing authors and just two amazing people, wonderful human beings. And I stated before, I am just, I mean, humbly honored that they had asked me to be part of these. So keep an eye open for that. Now, we're going to run a commercial here. We've got, over at Freshian Group, we've got some incredible authors as well. And one of them is Joseph Ajuluni. And Joseph Ajuluni, he's written a couple of word books. And these are resource books for writers. It'll give you stories and background on where certain words came from or certain turns of phrase, what their actual meanings are, what the actual phrases are as well, because there's a lot of times where we'll repeat a turn of phrase and it gets told the wrong way, but over time, that's kind of the settled version of that phrase. And then you dig into the history and you realize, oh, that's not what it was originally. So I'm going to go ahead and run a commercial here, and I'll see you on the other side.
Music has charms to soothe a savage breast. Nothing is certain but death and taxes. God helps those who help themselves. We've all heard these sayings, but have you ever wondered who said that? Hey, we've all looked for another way to say something, so wouldn't a resource for common ways of speaking come in handy? Or you could explore fun ways our language memes reach into the past. You could simply say, "You win." But other ways to say it. Grab the brass ring. Beat the odds. Get the gold. Hit the jackpot. Beat the pants off of them and many more. It's all figuratively speaking. Who said that? Figuratively Speaking by J. Ajuluni, author, playwright, and word maven. Educational but interesting and fun. Explore the many ways we use language and then keep these books for reference. They're available now as jacketed hardcovers, plus soft covers and ebooks, iBook, Kindle, Nook, Google Play, and more. Who said that? And Figuratively Speaking are proudly published by Fresh Ink Group.
Yeah, so these, like I said, these are resource books. You want to become a better writer, learn about the language, how the mechanics of it work, and the history of it. We do have a caller, so we're going to take one right now. Hello, caller. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
This is Robert.
Hello, caller.
I'm calling from...
Hi, Robert. Hi. How you doing?
Pretty good.
So,
calling from Centennial, Colorado, outside of Denver.
Okay. You got a work in progress you want to talk about?
I do have a work in progress, and I thought that some of your listeners might be interested in hearing about it.
Oh, yeah. All right. We got a lot of your fan base in our listening audience, so I can guarantee you they're going to be interested in what you got to share. So what are we working on?
Well, The last book that I published through you guys was Icebreaker, Operation Icebreaker, which is one of the Mac McDowell Mission series, the second in the series. And I am completing the third, Operation Arctic Sting. The second book, Operation Icebreaker, tells the story of Mac McDowell and his saturation diving team on a specially outfitted submarine called the USS Toothus. Toothus is a type of squid. Anyway, head up into the Arctic ice pack. Underneath the ice, they lay some special acoustic arrays, one off of Greenland and one off of Point Barrow, Alaska. In the process, they are dogged by a high-end Soviet submarine that ends up getting in trouble, and the crew abandons it, and surreptitiously they rescue the crew. The submarine is abandoned on the sea bottom. In Operation Arctic Sting, Mac and his crew, using the DSRV, the Deep Submergence Rescue Vehicle Mystic, board the abandoned Russian high-end Soviet submarine and find a way to move it underneath the Arctic ice pack all the way to Groton, Connecticut, and Electric Boat, where we build many of our submarines. The story is about this transit through the Arctic ice pack.
Fantastic. Yeah, having read much of your work, doing your audiobooks and putting together the various book trailers and all that, you take great pains to make sure that your stories are accurate. And I can tell you, listeners, these stories are amazing. You're not going to ever find anything that you're going to say, well, that can't be, because the man knows what he's talking about. Why don't you share a little bit about your background and how you know this stuff?
Well, this is Jill, Robert's wife, and I'm here to testify that he spends a very long time doing research, and he makes so much detail making sure that it's accurate from years ago. I don't think he could do this without the internet, but I mean, even the time of the tides back that many years at that location so that he knows that the submarine can make it through that spot. So I think it would be very difficult for any of the readers to find anything that conflicts with reality.
Yeah, that's, and I can attest to that. Like I said, having read much of his work, and that's the thing about it is the reality. It's a realism. It's almost like you're reading a somebody's memoir.
You asked me for a little bit of my background. Let me take a moment to just kind of summarize it.
Okay.
Grew up in Europe, son of missionaries, came to the States, ended up joining the submarine service as an enlisted sonar tech, got selected for a commissioning program, and ended up as an officer on U.S. nuclear submarines. I left the submarine service to go into the Man in the Sea program, which turned out to be, to my great surprise, turned out to be a cover for an amazing, surreptitious operation that I ended up leading a team of divers on called Operation Ivy Bells, which is the first of the three books, where we locked out of an old, aging nuclear submarine on the bottom of the Sea of Okhotsk and tapped into Soviet underwater communications cables. So I have spent many years in deep sea diving, saturation diving, submarining, and then I got lucky and got assigned to the South Pole and spent a year at the South Pole conducting atmospheric research. And I spent several years up in the Arctic ice pack doing something similar. So I've had an interesting background that took me from pole to pole and down on the equator, investigating manganese nodules and whether we can mine these things successfully. And believe it or not, somebody paid me to do all these things.
Wow, that's incredible. The things that you've seen and the places you've been, that's incredible.
it was kind of interesting that a friend of mine is the man who took the Bathyscaphe Trieste down to the bottom of the Marianas Trench for the very first time in very early 1960. And
wow.
I sent him the manuscript for Operation Ivy Bells to look it over and make any suggestions he cared to make. And he sent me back an email and said, "You will never believe where I am right now." And it turned out he was conducting a research project on a research ship up in the Sea of Okhotsk on the surface above where we had done all that amazing stuff so many years earlier.
Wow. Now, as you just stated, you do a lot of research. Is this ongoing as you're writing the story, or do you, you know, plot out your story, do the research, and then start writing it, or do you research before, during, and during the course of writing it?
Actually, before and during, especially with this kind of a story where the vessel is taking a certain path along with another vessel, and they're being harassed by Soviet submarines, I lay out the general outline, and then as the story progresses and as the characters start developing themselves and as events begin to happen, then I have a precise time frame and I can jump in and find out whether the sun was shining and whether it was above or below the horizon when they put the periscope up or when they broke through the ice, how long the shadows might have been, which way the tidal current was flowing, because they take some paths where the tidal current reaches as much as 10 or 11 knots, which is 10 or 11 miles per hour plus a little bit, really, really, really fast. It scours the bottom when this happens. And having this information accurate so that I time their arrival at high tide or at low tide or at maximum current makes a huge difference.
Yeah, that's meticulous right there. What's your writing schedule look like? Do you write every day? Do you have time set aside?
I get up in the morning, take care of what I have to take care of, and then I write. And at some point, I quit.
Yeah. That's, for me, there's some days where I'm just not motivated. And then there's days like I've been having the last week or so where I just got all this stuff. I've got to get it down. And so I'm spending hours at the keyboard and just writing it down. But I'm pretty meticulous about that, too. I've got a story that I'm working on right now that's set in 1977, and I grew up in that era. I remember the 70s well. But there are, like, certain things in there. Okay, I've pretty much researched a lot of it going into the story, but like you, as I'm writing it, I got to jump over to Google and, you know, the internet and take a look at, okay, well, were they doing this in 1977 or was that in 1978? So I'm constantly checking on that stuff, but yeah, that's that need for it to be real.
Let me give you an example of something I ran into. I was, you're familiar with the name Kate, the gal that Mac met near the end of Icebreaker.
Yeah.
Part of the new story consists of three chapters from her journal while she is taking care of herself while he's out doing this stuff. And in one of the chapters, one of her journal entries, she's talking about a coffee shop that she and a girlfriend went to. And what I had to do was find out, I had already put them in a condo in Georgetown that existed during that time. And then I had to find a coffee shop that existed then. Whether it exists now or not doesn't matter, but I had to find a coffee shop that existed then, and I had to determine what kind of a menu they had so that what they ate at the coffee shop was consistent with what was really going on then.
Yeah, there you go, listeners. That is called being meticulous. This is that's the realism of these incredible Robert G. Willis Croft stories.
One of the interesting things that Captain Walsh, the guy who went to the bottom of the Marianas Trench, one of the things that he said about my writing is that it's kind of like, Tom Clancy. He said, but the big difference is that Willis Cross been there and done that. And he defied the readers to find the line between infection.
That's good writing, and that's good storytelling. When you can't find that line, it's there. It's you're in it. All right. Well,
by the
I want to thank you.
I expect to have the novel. I expect to have the novel done this month. It'll be in your hands, I think, before Christmas, or certainly before New Year. And with any luck, we can get it out in the late February timeframe.
All right. So, listeners, if you haven't read any of the Mac McDowell series or any other Robert G. Willicroft books, get over to Amazon and type in Robert G. Willicroft, and I'm telling you, you're going to enjoy these stories. Well, Robert, we have another caller. Go ahead.
You can also go to robertwilliscroft.com. That'll take you to all of them.
There you go. Or you can even go to freshinkgroup.com, and under the members page, you can find Robert G. Willicroft's page, and that should take you to his Amazon page. It should take you to his robertwilliscroft.com. And I believe Twitter as well, possibly. So, hey, where can they find you on Twitter?
@RG Willicroft.
@RG Willicroft. Okay, there you go, listeners. Get over there to Amazon and take a look. Thank you for calling in, Robert, and being part of this. We do have another caller that I want to get to. So big appreciation. Thanks a lot. Say hi
Merry
to your
Christmas
wife, Mary, or goodbye to her. Merry Christmas to you as well. All right. We have coming up here on this line, I recognize that phone number, Mr. Verwayne Greenhoe. How you doing, Verwayne?
Not too bad, Beam. Thanks to talk to me tonight. Thank you for
talking
to me
tonight. Thanks for calling in and participating. I'm glad we had a couple of callers because, you know, I'm doing this solo tonight and I'm not really working off a script. I just thought I'm going to come in and talk about some works in progress, and hopefully people would call in. And you and Mr. Willicroft saved the day. So I know.
While you were talking to Robert, I went out and bought his book.
Okay. All right. There you go. I know you're a prolific writer. You've always got irons in the fire, so to speak. And I do know, let me go up here to Twitter real quick. I know you left a little thing here. It said, coming soon, who cares for the caregiver when the caregiver hits rock bottom? How to handle your grief and pain when your one and only is dying and you can't bear to put them away. When you can't take one more step, I show you how to keep going. How about you share a little bit more on that?
Well, as you know, my wife developed dementia after she had a stroke in January of 2014 and just kept going downhill. And as I tell people, she was dead. She was dead emotionally a good year and a half before she was dead physically. She died physically. And you can only answer the question, who are you? Why are you here? Just so many times without wanting to scream.
Yeah,
I can't leave her with anybody.
I can relate to that. My grandmother had Alzheimer's. I remember those questions, who are you? Who are you? Constantly. And it was, you know, every 5 minutes.
And it was just, you just want to scream. And you can run yourself straight into the ground. And thanks to my long career in both as a paramedic and then later on an emergency room nurse, I was able to, I call it fulfilling my oath of taking care of her in sickness and in health. And she did so much for me, you know, while she was up and moving, that I felt it was my duty to take care of her. And that's an overwhelming task. And I don't think a lot of people even begin to understand the depth of responsibility that you step into when you decide that you're going to take care of somebody who has dementia, Alzheimer's, and Parkinson's. So,
yeah,
just absolutely overwhelming. And you can't go anywhere. You have to lock up her medicines. I had to buy a safe to keep her medicines in because she knew that she hurt. She knew she was uncomfortable, and she knew the medicine would help. My wife was an OB nurse for 44 years and a darn good one. So she wanted to constantly get some medicine to make it go away. Well, the pain may have been real, but it was probably imagined, you know, and that's a real thing. We would always ask, is your pain, decide, the doctors would go, you know, is this real pain or is this imagined pain? Because one hurts just as bad as the other. And it got so that, you know, you can barely go on. And if you end up with a lot of, I hate to say it, but you end up with a lot of murder suicides when that condition continues. If you do not have ways to take care of yourself, it is a very deadly situation. As a paramedic, I saw that over and over and over again. And
I can imagine
where one took care of the other. So that book, I had started that story. And then I got just so far into it, I couldn't do it anymore because I found myself crying far too much, and I had to put it away. Well, then in between that step, I found my second wife. Well, she wasn't my wife then, but eventually became. And I was going through some files here the other day, and I gone, geez, I could finish this up with a week's worth of solid time. And that's one of the books I'm working on finishing. I hope to have done before Christmas. And I've got the cover all done. I might as well finish the interior.
Yeah.
But
go ahead.
I was going to say, I always keep multiple works in progress. And until I met my new wife, I was writing six time slots a day. I would begin at 9, and then I would write for an hour and 20 minutes, and then get up, do something, and come back and start the next story. Whichever one happened to catch my fancy, I would begin to work on that. Well, don't tell my wife, but I've now worked up to four. She made me cut down to two, and I've snuck back up to four times a day. But again, she's not supposed to know that. But I constantly, when I finish one story, I work in a noose. I have a folder I call my pile of bones, bone files, and I go through there and I go, okay, let's see what I can do with this bone. But keep moving them around, as my dad always used to say, catch as catch can, and just keep going. And then I have, lately I've been pushing a whole mess of my stories into Audible format, and I've been working with my narrators. This morning I approved the final work on Used and Abused that was my current wife's backstory. You read Finding Myself Again, details where I found her. Well, now I'm working on her backstory. And I had to change a bunch of details into that because she's got a very vindictive ex who, you had to fudge on some of the details. But some of the things that she told me became very, obviously very painful for her, but it became very painful to me as well. And we would spend a lot of time talking at night going through this to keep both of us from kind of getting too wound up into the deal. And it was very, I still want to say traumatic, but I've been pushing that story. I've got a woman who just finished up the audio on it this morning, so that will be coming out. ACX, I don't know if any of you were following ACX, but ACX seems to have thrown out the anchor, and I got an 85,000-word book turned into audio from 8 days from the day I submitted it to the time it was for sale, and now you can't it's taken. I had three this summer that were out there that were in ACX Tech for 7 months.
We just had one finally approved through ACX after probably 6 or 7 months. And we've got a few more that it's just that's one thing after another. And we ended up getting in touch with, calling in and talking to some people. And I believe we have a meeting with somebody coming up here soon that this is just not acceptable. I mean, come on.
Well,
like you said, throwing out the
and
anchor.
I agree. And I went, in fact, what began to make them move on mine, and you might try that, is tell them that you're going to move to Find a Voice. I think it's findavoice.com, which is commonly known as Chirp. Like ACX is the production model for Amazon, for Audible. Find a Voice works for Chirp.
Okay.
And I told them, I said, I want to remove my books from Audible. Well, they didn't want that crap because they begin to, real quick, all of a sudden my stories begin to move. And you might want to try that.
Yeah, I may be hollering at you for a little info on that. Now, a lot of your books are based on the realities of life that you've seen. What's your fiction writing looking like these days? Are you working on anything like a novel or short stories or anything like that?
Actually, I am. I'm going into... This may be a poor time to get into it, but dystopian or political dystopian stuff, and where you take the worst possible, you take your present reality, go into your worst possible thing there. But
that's reality. That's the reality of the world today.
Yeah, but I have right now. I wrote one in 2012. That I called the Tinfoil Hat Chronicles, and I'm just now getting it stuck into Audible. And he's the guy, Brian Moriarty, the guy who did One More for me. He had that, Devil May Care voice that I wanted for One More, which was a murder story. And he's doing very good. He's probably 5 hours into that story right now, and he's really nailing it, and I love that, just the tone of his voice. So Amazon has put that book up, taken that book down, put that book up, taken that down, and at one point in time it had like 70 ratings, and now it's got 4-star rating. And
why were they taking it down? What's the reasoning behind that?
They didn't like the point of view. They didn't like my point of view.
Oh, okay. Well, and, so they're critics now? I mean...
well, you got Facebook, You got to be careful what you say on Facebook, or you'll be booted for good.
Yeah, I mean, Facebook and YouTube and even Twitter, I mean, I expect that the way they're biased against one point of view. I wouldn't expect that from Amazon, though.
Oh, yeah. That book was selling quite well. And it the really odd part about it was I wrote that as it was developing. I started writing that story September 9th, 2011. Do you remember what happened 2 days later?
Uh-huh. I
the
sure
Benghazi.
Do.
The Benghazi thing. And then I found an odd blog, Lame Cherry. Now, allegedly, lamecherry.blogspot, I think it is. Woman is crazier than sin. But I'd been reading her just because I thought it was funny. And then all of a sudden she began to talk about things that she knew that had happened that night. And she knew way too much. And the passage of time has proved that she was about 99.9999% correct. And I based my story then on what she was writing, the information she was giving. And she was far too close, far
wow.
too close to true. But I'm writing a political dystopian thing based on the virus.
Okay.
That talks about where CIA and FBI go completely and totally rogue, and things begin to go. You know, who'd have thunk it?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that going on in the world today. I really do.
Yes, sir. But I wrote. I'm also come up with a new one. I included you, as you remember. I sent out my my email, my monthly email, and I included you in that last one.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And remember, I told you I was looking for questions that you to women that they would like to ask a man, for a male to respond to. I got 70 responses off that thing.
Wow.
And it's called, tentatively called, Since You Asked. And it's crazy, the excellent questions that I got. And it's just going to be, you know, these women ask me questions, and now I'm going to give them my answers. You know, you may not like what I write, but you ask.
Yeah.
Since you ask, you're going to catch my
opinion. Some of the, without inflaming anybody, what are some of the questions? You know, give us two or three examples of the questions that they came up with.
Okay. Actually, I have them here.
Okay.
I got a lot of women going, women ask me, why do men constantly want to grab my boobs? I'm dead serious.
They're still doing that?
Who'd have thought you'd have thought that would have wore out when we was kids, huh?
Yeah, I mean, we're living in a whole different era with, you know, the whole Me Too and people saying, hey, that's not acceptable behavior anymore. And you would think that, you know, but I guess, you know, there's still going to be some of those rogue guys out there.
I got a lot of questions about why do men think this? Why? And some of these are, I dare say, misconceptions, but I've been lucky. I was lucky in the fact that I had a father who taught me better than that crap.
Yeah, same here. I had a father and a grandfather.
My dad told me when I was 17, embarrassed the ever-loving crap out of me. And I brought him home a girl. I brought home a girl for him to meet. And I asked him later what he thought. And he says to me, again, I cannot even begin to explain how embarrassed I got when he said this. He said to me, he says, you need to remember something. He says, long after the sex is boring, you still got to talk to her.
Yeah, there you go.
So, because she'd been a pretty girl. She was a nice girl, but, you know, she had no chance of really cracking the top 10 in her class. And Dad would always Aesop had his fable. Dad always had his stories, you know. He would tell me this big, long thing, and then he says, now, I told you all that, so you better understand this. And, you know, it was when I bought my first car, he took it into town, filled it up, and then he says to me, gives me the keys, and he says, doesn't cost any more to keep a car full than it does to keep a car empty. Took me 3 years to figure that out. But, yeah, I caught it.
You got a book called Things My Father Taught Me, right?
Yep. Things My Father Taught Me, Lessons in Life.
Yeah, and, so I'm guessing there's a lot of that in that book.
Well, exactly. And he would teach me, well, I was always scared of thunder and lightning. I was born and raised on a farm. And we had one day, we were out in the barn, and we had a monster lightning storm come through. And I was just absolutely quivering. And then he told me, he says, he always called me Doc because I wanted to be a doctor. And he said, Doc, he says, you need to understand. He says, about the time you begin to think that you're high and you're mighty and you're this and you're that, he says, all it takes is one bolt of lightning to make you understand how infinitely small and insignificant you are in this world.
Amen. Amen.
So,
you know, the thing I find cool about this book that you've written that chronicles your father's wisdom. Your father's not here anymore, but it chronicles his wisdom, and this is something that other people can learn from. I've read many books like that from, you know, things that people learn from other people. And they're amazing because you're saving this man's wisdom and you're sharing it with other people. And I think that's fantastic. Well,
I wrote a short story. It was called Keep Your Eyes Open. It's a very short story and it's a true story. My sister died December 19th, 2010, had a massive heart attack. I'd called her that morning to get some information to help me write things my father. Well, 3 years later, December 19th, 2013, my brother was shot and murdered in South Carolina over a $15 marijuana deal.
Oh,
man. He gave the guy a 20, asked for his change back, and the guy shot him.
That's crazy. That's insane.
Yeah, well... But when I was on my way home, I was living in Florida, and my job was to pick him up in South Carolina and bring him home I had a big Chevy Blazer, had the casket in the back, and I was getting tired, and I could keep hearing this voice going, open your eyes, Doc, keep your eyes open. Well, pulled off into this little restaurant area, and I walked in there, and I know it was my dad, because only my dad ever called me Doc, and he said, Doc, open your eyes. I didn't see it, and then all of a sudden, I see this woman sitting there, and she's got two little boys, and they're real fidgety, and I listened to part of her. I had to go to the bathroom, and I come out, and I heard her telling the boys, going, I'm hungry, Mama, I'm hungry, I want to go home. And she says, you can't. You know why. And finally, I said, I don't know what your problem is. I said, but if your boys are hungry, I've got more than enough money. And I ended up buying them food. And she's going, oh, you don't need to. And I said, kids, you know, it's hard enough for adults to understand what's going on around them, let alone a five-year-old kid to not understand why he's hungry and you – in a restaurant, you can't eat. Well, long story short, my dad kept telling me, I know it was my dad. He kept telling me, Doc, open your eyes. And finally asked him, why can't you go home? And then she tells me that her husband had left her. It was 3 days before Christmas, and they had shut her electricity off. And she had no place to go. So... when I travel, I use my credit card for gas and everything, but occasionally, I always keep 90 to 100 bucks in cash in my car. So I had a four-year-old grandson at that point in time, so I went and got a bunch of his toys that I'd bought from him, give them to those kids, and then but while I'm there, these truck drivers come out there, and they cornered me, and they're going, what's wrong with the lady you're with? I explained it to him, and he says, you keep her busy. He says, I'll do something. Well, by the time they were all done, they came there to the table where we were at, And they said to her, he says, your friend here has told us what's going on. He says, I went to all the truckers here in this little stop. He says, I've gathered up a little over $780.
Wow.
He says, and I've set you up. He says, and I know a guy who runs a motel just up the way, and he's going to front you a room for 5 days until you get back on your feet.
That's a fantastic story there. That lets you know that they're still good in the world, even though sometimes it doesn't seem like it. Sometimes it just seems dark and useless.
You know, I worked as a medic, and I know this. I know what this night's about. But as a medic, I saw things. I saw people die that had no reason to die. But then again, I saw people who live who had absolutely, positively no reason medically why they should have been alive after what they've been through.
Yeah, which kind of, you know, which leads me to a question I was thinking of a little while ago. With your background, and you talked about, you know, people that had the murder, suicides, and just some of the darkness that you've seen. I'm guessing there's probably quite a few humorous stories that you've seen as well.
Oh yeah.
And would you ever consider, you know, like writing a book on those kind of stories, the funny side of what you did?
Actually, both my first wife and now Lisa is encouraging me, because Judy was an OB nurse. Lisa was an ER nurse like I was. And we got talking about some of the funny things. And I'll tell you one that I thought she was going to laugh herself to death about. We had on an Easter Sunday, we had this woman come in who was, to say the least, constipated. Well, it happened to be my turn to do what they call a disimpaction.
Oh, that doesn't sound like
right
any fun.
There. Well, we got in there, and I'm slowly getting her cleaned out, slowly getting her, and just all of a sudden, you heard about breaking, having a dam breakthrough. Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a whole lot of
kind
fun.
Of things, kind of. Yeah. Oh, the rest of the girls laughed at me in the ER. And in retrospect, it is funny. But, there's a lot of things. A lot of things that went on. We've begun to collect stories of things that had happened that were funny in the emergency room. Well, I had a woman, routine ambulance call early in the morning. She needed to be transported to the emergency or to the hospital. And I'm in the back and I'm talking to her, getting the paperwork filled out. And I said, why are you going to the hospital? And she says, well, I have to get a barbarian enema.
Said, barbarian enema?
I said, you mean a barbarian enema? She looks at me just serious as can be, and she says, you, sir, have obviously never had one.
Wow.
So, but life is, you know, that was the one salvation of working in the ER. There was a lot of bad stuff went on. A lot of bad stuff, but there was also a lot of funny stuff that went on. And I have a lot of those. So.
I from time to time I watch one of the cable shows, True Stories from the ER, and there's a lot of interesting stories in there, strange things, and but they often they'll throw a humorous story in there. You got the serious one, and then they'll throw a little bit of a humorous one in there, and that's what I kind of like, you know, because it's life. There's going to be moments where it's just dark and dismal, and then there's other moments where you're going to see something funny in that or something humorous, something to lift the spirit and give you a laugh.
When you're in the business, you live for those days. So There were days there that made you wanna cry, but there were a lot of days there where you're going, count one for the good guys. Something went right. And I'll promote one other book, The Touch. And I highly recommend the Audible book over the paperback. But The Touch had to do with a situation. My partner and I called it the deal in the ditch. My partner, Steve, and I, we called each other. I was his best man. He was mine. And his wife, future wife, and my future wife lived together, and Steve and I lived together, and we told people we just swapped roommates. Well,
there's
we
a
got there,
in that.
And, but it was Steve and I always had things under control, and the Michigan State Police called us the dynamic duo, and they would call us when things got out of hand from other people. And he would, but they would want us out there because nothing shook us. But we got out there and we found this rickety old Dodge van. I mean, this was like 70, 75, 76 when this happened. And this van was from the 50s. And one of the little boys had stopped breathing. Now, every time I tell this story, I get the shivers. So, they got up there and I began to, typically if you've got a heartbeat and you give two or three real good deep breaths, the breathing center kicks in the way it's supposed to. We got everything cleared off and I started doing it. We're in the ditch of a church, in front of a church on a Sunday morning. And there are probably no less than 150 people standing out there watching me work on this little boy. And he's not breathing. He's not making an attempt to breathe. He's making absolutely, positively no attempt to breathe. And I knew something was wrong. Well, you get that kind of thing. People want to push forward. They want to see what you're doing. And I kept telling people, get back, get back, get back. Now, this was early spring. It was still pretty nippy. And I had a man walk up behind me. He's wearing sandals and somewhat of a shirt. I mean, like a suit jacket with a pretty plain shirt on underneath it, and he grabbed me by my right shoulder, and I turned around to say to him, tell him, let go of me, get back, and he was mumbling something, and I heard, all I heard, being strike me dead if this ain't true, he said, Father, let him do this. And then all of a sudden, it was like I'd been, you ever touch an electric fence out on a farm?
I did. I grew up on a horse farm and I grabbed it many a times or just brushed into it.
Yes. So, yes.
Nice joke.
But it was like that. But
wow.
I give this kid two more breaths. And all of a sudden, he, I don't know if you've heard the term Shane stoking, where they, and I finally got him straightened out, and he began to breathe. And we got him loaded, and we headed to the hospital. And he woke up just as we're backing into the bay. And his parents are there, and we get him in there. And I explained everything that had happened. I mean, I didn't explain to the doctor, you know, I thought Jesus grabbed me or anything like that, because people think I'm crazy as it is. And but I was still, my shoulder hurt. I was still pretty upset about what had happened because I couldn't explain it. Anything you can't explain, you worry about. Well, I sit there and I talk to him. I talk to this. His parents hunted me down, and they were very poor people. You didn't have to go, you know, what kind of credit card you got. You knew these people were dirt poor. The kid was dirty. The parents were dirty. And he is on his knees kissing my feet. And he's going, wow. You saved my son. You saved my son. You saved my son. And I told him, sir, I had absolutely nothing to do with what happened to your son. Well, we snuck out of the hospital because I wasn't handling that the best. But I went down to the church, and I talked specifically to the minister. I said, "Who was that?" He said, "I didn't see it." I said, "You were standing right there." I said, "You heard me talking to the guy." He said, "I heard you talking." He said, "But I don't know who you were talking to. I didn't see anything." Long story short, word began to get out that we had performed a miracle. And the local newspaper, whose name I will not mention because they're still a piece of trash, sent a reporter out, and they had done a little thing there where, you know, they had portrayed me over the line drawing type thing, me saving this little boy. And that's not what happened, but she came, they sent a reporter to me, and it was a gotcha thing. And I knew as soon as I answered one question wrong, I knew what was going to happen. Well, we ended up getting a whole mess of people started coming to our ambulance base because they were bringing in people who they wanted to be touched and things like this. Like Steve and I finally explained to him, "We don't know what you've heard. We don't have that ability, but we will talk to you." Well, for the next 7-8 months, we had a steady inflow of people who would come in, and people just needed to talk. How many people out there do you know who probably would benefit greatly from just talking to them?
Oh, there's a whole bunch of them. I mean, that's, you know, I've benefited it from that for myself personally over the years, just sitting down and being able to talk about something, to get off the chest.
Well, these people, well, Steve and I began to turn these kids, I mean, to these people, this old woman, she couldn't walk very well, and her husband, I mean, he's an old man, and he carried her in there. And we ended up talking to them. Long story short, you can make a lot of people feel a lot better if you just say hello to them, if you just shake their hand, talk to them. But
yeah.
Now, the only thing that wasn't true about that story, I just want to interject something here.
The sad thing, like what you just said, saying hello to people, the sad thing is, and I see this in our world today, you go to a grocery store and nobody even wants to make contact with you, eye contact. They're all masked up and standing 6 feet apart, and they're offended if you're too close to them or whatever. And this is what our world has been turned into. This is
not mine.
Now we fear each other, and I, you know, it's, to me, it's all nonsense. But this is what's happened.
Well, but we had, now I, at the end of this, at the end of that story, to be truthful, everything to that point in that story was true, but I did a little flipping around. I got shot at a bar fight. I mean, I was there as a medic, not as a
combatant.
And I ended up, oh no. I got better things to waste my money on. but I was a drunk for 6 weeks in college, and then I saw the stupidity in that, and haven't drank anything since I was 18. So,
well,
but,
good for you.
We had an officer murdered, who I flipped the circumstances around. I was with him, and the only reason this cop was there was because he'd heard that we had been dispatched out to see this one guy who was just ultra mean, ultra violent, ultra – just the guy was just – he had a severe psychological problem. And he came out to me. He came out. He called me on the radio, and he says, "Hey, I hear you're going out so-and-so's place." He says, "I'm on my way home." He says, "That's only a block off my – away from my house." He says, "Why don't you hold on until I get there?" And the guy's nickname was Mac. And we went there, and the guy had standing in the doorway of his thing. And he says, well, I'll talk to Mac. He says, I'll talk to Mac. He says, but I ain't talking to you guys. Well, I told Mac, don't go. Don't go. Mac went up there anyway, took about four steps beyond me. And the guy just reached around the corner, pulled out a shotgun, and killed him.
Well, dang, man, that's crazy.
I've seen three murders like that. Three times I was close enough to somebody getting shot where I had to go take a shower to get the debris away from me. But it's a goodwill story. And like I said, the paperback is good, but I got a guy to narrate that who was exactly what I wanted. I mean, if you're going to get somebody to narrate a story, know the voice that you want.
I've listened to a couple of your audio books, and I can tell you seem to find the right voices to match these up, and that's quite amazing. Now, we're just about out of time, so why don't you tell people where they can find you on Twitter?
Well, on Twitter, it's at Verwain Author.
At Verwain Author. And you can find all of his books and audio books on Amazon. Just go to Amazon and look for Verwain Greenhoe. And he's got a lot of really, really good works out there.
And I enjoy writing. And like I said, this thing, the last two that I wrote about my new wife, people are just going crazy over. And you read one that I know of. I don't know if you read the last one, but
yeah. I've got a pile of to be read books, and you've got a few more in that pile. I'm trying to break them down I'm writing. I've got a couple of I got a novel and a novella that I'm working on right now, and so I have to kind of juggle my time, but I will definitely get to those.
I hear you.
I want to thank you for calling in and being part of this and making this so it wasn't such a train wreck with me just trying to talk to myself out here. But we are out of time. So, thank you, Verwain, and I want to wish you a Merry Christmas, you and your wife both, and have a Happy New Year. Hopefully 2021 is a lot better.
Amen.
Okay,
thank you,
well,
sir. Appreciate it.
Thanks for calling in. And listeners, thank you all for tuning in and spending a Wednesday evening with just little old me tonight and my two callers, Robert G. Willis-Croft and Verwain Greenhoe. And we will be off next week because of the holidays, but we'll be sharing an encore presentation of our short story episode from a couple of months ago. And that was kind of a neat one. So keep a lookout for that. And if you miss any of these shows, go check them out in the archive. You can go to our YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube, type in Fresh Ink Group. You can go to freshinkgroup.com, beamweeks.com, or stephenjees.com. And at all three of those sites, just click on the podcast button and you'll see all of our previous episodes. You can find us on Twitter at Fresh Ink Group and at Voice of Indy. You can find us on Instagram at Fresh Ink Group and at Fig Publishing. That's FIG Publishing. And find us on Facebook at Fresh Ink Group LLC. And with that, we will catch you live again in about 2 weeks. Stay safe, everybody, and have a Merry Christmas.
You've been a part of Voice of Indy, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.